National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security. We're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. Our topic for today's show is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Professor Brenda Schaefer is an international energy and foreign policy specialist. Her focus areas include the interplay between natural gas trade and foreign policy, politics and energy in the South Caucasus, Iranian natural gas exports, ethnic politics in Iran, and Eastern Mediterranean energy. Professor Schaefer is currently a research faculty of the Energy Academic Group at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. She also serves as a senior advisor for energy at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies think tank and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Policy or Global Energy Center, in Washington, D.C. Professor Brenda Schaefer has authored several books, including Energy Politics, which is used as a textbook in over 200 university courses around the globe. Brenda is also the author of the book, Iran is More Than Persia, Ethnic Politics in Iran, and we'll touch on that book a bit today. She's also co-author of the forthcoming textbook, Operational Energy. Professor Schaefer frequently provides research and expert counsel to international institutions, governments, energy companies, financial institutions, and regional security organizations. Schaefer has served as an advisor to Israel's Prime Minister's Office and Minister of Energy on policy related to major natural gas discoveries in Israel. She's advised several companies involved in Caspian energy production and export. She has given testimony to several committees of the U.S. Congress, including the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and to the European Parliament. Brenda frequently appears on Bloomberg TV and in major news outlets worldwide to provide insight on developments in the global oil market. Brenda's held a variety of academic appointments, including serving as a tenured professor at the University of Haifa, a visiting professor at Bifrost University in Iceland, I have to ask more about that one, and at the Azerbaijan Diplomatic Academy. She previously served as the research director for the Caspian Studies Program at Harvard University. Dr. Schaefer earned a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science and International Relations from Hebrew University of Jerusalem and followed those studies by earning a Master's degree in Political Science with a specialization in Russian Studies, also at Hebrew University. She completed her doctorate at Tel Aviv University. Professor Brenda Schaefer, welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you so much.
And where are you sitting this morning for our show? You and I are on Zoom, but you're clearly not here in the studio here in Minnesota.
Right now in Washington, D.C., but I wish I was in Minnesota.
Is the heat coming on
yet? I understand it's a beautiful place to spend the summer.
Ah, is the heat and humidity coming on in D.C. yet?
Not yet, but I've heard wonderful things about tourism and summer tourism in Minnesota.
It is pretty nice here. It is pretty nice. Dr. Schaefer, let's go ahead and dive into our topic. You are an expert on Iran. I want to make sure that we pull every bit of information we can out of you. Our topic for today, the Islamic Republic of Iran, or as most people just refer to it, Iran. You spent a good bit of your career looking at Iran. What was it about Iran that caught your interest as a scholar, and why have you invested so much of your career studying and writing about Iran?
I mean, that's a great question. I would say that because Iran borders both the Caspian region, Caucasus, Central Asia, and at the same time the Middle East, it's a very interesting combination, you know, sort of a Silk Roads country, so combination of cultures and behaviors. And of course, it's a very important country because of its geographic location and specifically under this current regime, you know, basically Iran, whether you like it or not, has a huge impact on U.S. national security, affects the security and stability of almost every regime in the Middle East, you know, and now is an ally of Russia and frequently intervenes in the South Caucasus, undermining some of its neighbors. So it's a very, I guess, because you know, we have sort of in the international system status quo states and anti-status quo states and, you know, those that kind of want to keep the system as it is. And Iran is, I guess, would be one of the poster childs for the anti-status quo states.
The disruptors. I think it'd be helpful for everyone if we sort of, you know, spent a little time talking about Iran's government, maybe a little bit how it's organized, the state of their economy, maybe some discussions about sort of the ethnic groups that exist inside Iran. That will help us have a foundation before we maybe get into some of the security studies part. That said, can you start with explaining to our listeners kind of how Iran's government is organized and how it functions?
Right. So, you know, a lot of regimes in the international system, they have institutions that might, if you sort of look superficially, and you might think, oh, there's elections going on, there's a constitution, there's rights. You know, and so Iran has this a lot, where a lot of journalists will tell you, oh, the outcome of a certain election and you know, what's the law on a certain thing. But basically, Iran, the current under the Islamic Republic, has basically a dual system where there's a supreme leader, which basically him and the institutions under him really make any of the meaningful decisions. And then there's a whole bunch of, you know, ministries, function under the so-called elected president. There is a judicial system, but basically they have very little power. You know, so they engage more in sort of day-to-day running of the country. But you know, any substantial decision will be by the supreme leader. And sort of the ironic part, I had a professor when I was a student, David Menashri, and he used to say that it's not the Islamic revolution, but it's actually the revolution in Islam, because in Shia Islam, unlike, let's say, Catholicism, a lot of Christian churches, it doesn't have a strong hierarchy, you know, where like someone a pope is chosen, and then the cardinals are elected, and you know, and they have their different functions, right? In Shia Islam, it's actually bottom up, where an ayatollah is formed by someone who just people follow him, you know, sort of basically by the strength of his teachings, so the idea that a political framework would impose who the ayatollahs are is exactly the opposite of how Shia Islam actually chooses its leaders. And in fact, traditionally in Shia Islam, they stay out of holding political office. Like their idea is that they should advise or influence people, but they shouldn't actually, you know, you shouldn't be in charge of collecting the garbage. And so basically the Islamic Republic, by sort of attempting to represent Shia Islam, actually embodies sort of the opposite of the principles of Shia organization.
I'm glad you brought that up. It really is a fundamental change in what Shia Islam is supposed to be about. And we should highlight for our listeners that Iran is sort of the center of Shia Islam. Most Muslims across the world are Sunni. Is that right?
Well, that's true. I mean, that's true that Iran is the largest population of Shia Muslims, and that most are Sunni. But I don't think Iran represents most Shia in the world. And I think most of you know, the other big Shia communities like Azerbaijan, Bahrain, Iraq, you know, certainly in the case of Azerbaijan and Bahrain, they would not see Iran, you know, as their leader and somehow that they're following. And in Iraq, it's kind of split. That's kind of, you know, part of the struggle in Iraq is that, you know, Iran really tries to run the country there. And you know, it's a sort of a player in the, or a dominant player in the domestic politics. But, you know, and certainly in terms of, you know, traditionally the centers of Shia Islam are actually in Iraq. They're not, you know, they're not in Iran. And sort of even the Islamic Republic, by trying to set up Qom as being, you know, a more important center than, you know, it was actually, again, it's more like the politics tried to dictate the religion versus, you know, versus the opposite. So, but I'd say also in foreign policy, despite its rhetoric, Iran doesn't really stand up for Muslims. And I know that's going to sound a bit surprising because all, you know, that's what you hear about their rhetoric, but anytime their state interests have come into conflict, you know, or let's say their power interests of the regime staying in power have come into conflict with the interests of different Muslim groups in their bordering areas. They've always chosen state interest, power, you know, stability of the regime. And, you know, good example is Chechen Muslims. You know, at the time in the 90s when Russia's, you know, Moscow's bombing the hell out of them, and really tens of thousands dying in the month by month, and Iran, you know, continues to cooperate with Moscow. If at all, they use the Chechen thing to even elicit more support from Russia. And we have also on Iran's borders, Christian Armenia invaded Shia Azerbaijan, kicked a million people out of their homes, you know, refugees. And actually Iran sides with Armenia in this conflict because of its, you know, state interest. So they don't tend to, despite their rhetoric, they don't tend to really uphold the rights and needs of different Muslim communities around the world.
I'd like to just talk just a brief bit more about the Iranian government. So you mentioned the supreme leader. It's my understanding the supreme leader chooses all members of the judiciary personally. Is that right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, personally, but has the authority. Yeah.
Okay.
So the judiciary in no way is independent. And and even the law, you know, the laws are quite strict, and you know, we're seeing now, I mean, it's just such an uneven application of law. Like, let's say the mayor of Tehran, previous mayor of Tehran, he shot his wife while she was in the shower in cold blood, and he's out of jail after 4 years. And people, young people that participated in the demonstrations and maybe threw a garbage can at the police forces, you know, they're being executed now. So it's really a completely politicized judiciary system. It also has a problem, you know, that about half the population of Iran isn't fluent in Persian, but it all is run in Persian. So if you're ever a defendant or an interrogation, you know, it could end up that you don't even understand, you know, the whole process that you're undergoing. So again, this is where we have institutions that they look like their judiciary or something that looks like an election, but it's really more on the formal side and not in terms of content.
Let's tap into a little bit more of your expertise on ethnic politics in Iran. Now, the people of Iran do get to elect their members of parliament and the president of Iran, but the candidates, as I understand it, for the president have to be approved by the supreme leader. But
right.
when we're talking about elections for parliament members and for the president of Iran, how does the ethnic politics across Iran play out? It's as you said in the title of your book, it's more than Persians, right? There's a whole bunch of different ethnic groups in Iran. Can you talk us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, so we often refer to, you know, Iran as Persia, Persian music, Persian food, the Persians. But, you know, just like we learned that the Soviets were not the Russians and that, you know, and suddenly when that started to open up, we understood there were, wow, Chechens and Uzbeks and Georgians and Lithuanians and all, you know, all sorts of people. So the same thing is pretty similar with Iran, where it's much more, you know, complicated, complex ethnic makeup. But over half of the population of Iran isn't Persian. The biggest minority groups are the Azerbaijani Turks. There's also the northern peoples, Gilan, Mazandaran, Kurds, Baluch, Arabs, Turkmen. So most of the ethnic minorities populate the bordering provinces. And so this leads to two things. One, not only are they not, you know, they're not allowed to use their language or to educate their children in schools in their language, but they actually, because they're in the periphery, they have a lot lower level of government services. They have, you know, human development indicators. And at the same time, it's a force that influences Tehran's foreign policy. So, you know, if you're thinking about your, you know, if you're having problems with Pakistan on border, like we just had like last week, or I believe on Monday, five Iranian border guards on the border with Pakistan killed, you know, and they're probably local ethnic Baluch, but they have family members on both sides. So sort of a domestic security issue becomes also a foreign policy issue. And we see this almost on every Iranian border, that the ethnic issue comes into their foreign policy considerations towards their neighbors.
How do the ethnic breakdowns impact elections for the Iranian government?
You know, as you said, it's a chosen list, you know, so it's sort of like going into a a restaurant and they said, well, you can only have the grapefruit and the cottage cheese. You can't order anything else. You know, so I don't know, you know, how much the elections really, you know, reflect something on the ground. And the one thing that is interesting is that there are local council elections, and these in the Persian populated areas, these are not, usually people don't go out to vote. They don't care a lot, but in the ethnic populated areas, they tend to come out in higher rates because they see it as their only way to have sort of some kind of influence over their local governance.
It sounds to me that there's a good bit of friction between the Persian-controlled central government and kind of the ethnic provincial areas around the periphery of Iran. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe it's true, and I believe it's true historically. Like, if you look throughout the 20th century, every time there was a weakening of Tehran, then suddenly the ethnic groups rise up and they try to have self-rule or independence. And, you know, so but the problem is, and again, like, as anyone who followed the Soviet Union over the years, right, that when you have suppression, you don't really know what the ethnic groups think, what they're doing, and even themselves. You know, there's one thing, it's a lot of it about, people ask, well, do the minorities want independence, they want to break up Iran. It's not, you know, a lot of it depends on opportunity, right? Will someone go and for their independence go and, you know, get themselves killed or hung, or, you know, I you know, that's very different than if there's sort of some weakness of central control and they have an opportunity to do things without, you know, with lower costs. And this is what we saw with the Soviet Union breakup. I could say that I don't know how many of the leaders of Central Asia thought of independence before Moscow was basically, you know, Russia itself, in a sense, pulled out of the Soviet Union. But once they had the opportunity, they definitely wanted it and developed it. And so I think a lot will depend, as you know, how events evolve in Tehran.
So we'll return to that topic a little bit later in our discussion. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Brenda Schaefer from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and we're discussing the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, and you can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. Dr. Schaefer, you've concentrated a great deal of your academic study, and you play an important role as an advisor in the field of energy. That's obviously a huge field, globally significant for everything that happens in the global economy. But when we talk about Iran, energy is a very important aspect of Iran's overall economy. Iran has traditionally been a major player in the history of oil and gas commodities, but their ability to export oil and gas has been, I'd say, significantly curtailed for years by international sanctions on Iran, placed on Iran due to the Iranian government's activities across the Middle East and even around the world. Can you give us kind of a general rundown on how the Iranian economy is functioning today? Maybe cover the major sectors which Iran specializes in, including oil and gas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, in there's been a lot of ups and downs, and in an almost paradoxical way, the U.S. and global sanctions in the early, around 2012, 2000, started under the Obama administration, they actually helped Iran solve a major economic problem, which was that Iran had extensive public subsidies for almost all goods. You know, certainly fuel was a few cents a gallon. You know, electricity was almost free. Bread, chicken, everything was subsidized. And of course, when you have subsidies, you have waste. You know, and you have it's probably better that people allocate their own money than the government allocates their money. And you know, a lot of corruption, a lot of waste. And the minute those sort of comprehensive sanctions were imposed, it sort of, Iran went over to a war economy and was able to remove a lot of the sanctions. And that actually, inadvertently helped the economy, you know, get on a better track when there wasn't all this waste. It was about 16% of GNP that was going to subsidies at the time. And you would see, I remember I was traveling in East Turkey and with a road trip, and I see a guy that, I don't know, you couldn't really call it a gas station, but it was a donkey with two gasoline canisters on each side of the donkey. And you could, you could fuel your car from the donkey. So I went up to him. So I was just kind of interested. I've never taken, you know, fuel from a donkey before. And I asked him, like, where is he from? He said he's, like, from Iran. He comes over the border with the cheap fuel and he sells it in Turkey, right? So you end up, if you have, you know, subsidies, these goods end up being smuggled to places that don't subsidize. And, you know, and you take advantage of the price gap. That's, you know, just one example. But also, the sanctions allow the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, to actually completely control the Iranian economy. So almost every major sector, you know, telecommunications, power production, cement production, construction, it's connected to one, you know, one or different elements in the Revolutionary Guards. That's like one of the reasons why, you know, they will fight for the death to keep their power in the regime, because it's not just about, you know, being politicians or even ideology, but it's really they control the economy, and, you know, people would lose their livelihood. This second round of sanctions that initially imposed by the Trump administration in 2018 and still continued under the Biden administration, essentially they're not really, at least under the Biden administration, they're not really being enforced. Essentially, Iran can export its oil pretty freely, and it continues to export its natural gas. And with the oil exports, they have to sell at somewhat of a discount, and because it's sanctioned oil. But with oil prices being so high over the last couple of years, it's still pretty big revenue. And now with the sanctions on Russian oil, there's sort of a competition in the illicit oil market between Iranian and Russian oil. And of course, the big benefactor of this market we've set up of oil, you know, sort of sanctioned oil, Russian and Iranian oil that's being traded at a discount, and then sort of the global oil market, is that China is the huge benefactor of this system, because essentially they buy, you know, one of the biggest inputs into to economies, which is oil. They buy it at about a third cheaper than the West does. So, you know, so think about it. If you had a store and one store is paying, you know, a third less on electricity than their neighbor, you know, obviously they're going to be more, have a competitive edge. So we've set up a system that's very oil system that's very beneficial to China.
Yeah, you know, we've done a few shows here on National Security This Week talking about sanctions, and the more stringent the sanctions are that are placed on a country, and the longer they last, it incentivizes that nation to basically fundamentally change the structure of their economy and to kind of go without and to build internal capacity for all those supplies. That's particularly true in the arms market when those arms embargoes are instituted. Is that what we're seeing in Iran, basically? I mean, that's what I think I'm hearing from you, is that Iran's economy has now become significantly more independent of the global supply chain. To a certain extent, is that right?
Yeah, no. I mean, I would say, you know, I mean, it needs to export oil because that's its major economic input, but it doesn't. You know, it's basically there's no the Biden administration doesn't really enforce the sanctions on oil. It's just maybe once in a while there's, you know, some sort of disruption. But yeah, I think that in general, the U.S. and the West has to be very careful about how we use sanctions, whether it's applied to Iran. Or we use sanctions far too much. Why do we use sanctions? Like when something happens that we don't like Iranian nuclear program, Russian invasion of Ukraine, and we want to be able to do something, right? We don't want to just stand by and do nothing. On the other hand, we don't really want to, you know, go to war or anything that could, you know, escalate, right? So the easy thing is always just to call for sanctions. But we never look at, like, do they change the behavior of the other side? You know, is there an off ramp? You know, in the case of, you know, oil, I mean, we it was so obvious that we were going to do something, you know, the minute China wasn't going to join the you know, Iran sanctions, Russia sanctions, it was clear that they were just going to benefit from it. And, you know, so maybe we need to widen our toolbox when it comes to Iran, I believe also with Russia, and look at things beyond sanctions, because they're really not changing the behavior of the U.S. adversaries.
So a little greater agility in the sanctions regime. How are sanctions impacting, you talked about the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps sort of controlling a heck of a lot of the economy inside of Iran. How are the sanctions impacting the ethnic groups around Iran? Is that part of economic opportunity being significantly lessened, I would assume? Is that impacting the other ethnic groups around Iran besides the Persians? Is that part of what the burr under the saddle is for all the demonstrations that have been taking place?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sanctions affect, all in Iran, but what I've heard from many, many members of opposition groups in Iran, and they also say this, and, even with television broadcasts, talking about people on the ground in Iran, not people abroad, that they still prefer the sanctions and have a chance to bring down the regime, and they're willing to undergo the costs. And I've heard this from many activists in Iran that, that even if the U.S. removed the sanctions, all this would mean is that the top people would get richer. It doesn't really affect them. There's very little, trickling down of the, the economic activity of the heads of the IRGC. And so I think many people on the ground, including with this current anti-regime movement, you don't hear anyone calling for removal of sanctions. Like they're willing to endure them, if they think it would bring down the regime.
So what about Belt and Road? We've talked about that quite a bit. China's initiative to create this Belt and Road economic system throughout the region. Clearly, Iran is in a good geographic position to benefit from the Belt part of this as it expands across the Central Asian republics. How will Belt and Road positively impact Iran's economy, economic development as it moves in that direction? Do you see any of that impact happening already?
Right. So one of the big, one of the major strategic results of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and with, both sanctions and more awareness to, supply chain security, and the need for or the problem with any transit through Russia from both, the Western side and the Russian side, with all sorts of limitations, is that we've really seen the rise of the Middle Corridor, which is a transit corridor that goes between China and Europe, but it doesn't go through Russia. And initially, for years, sort of the Northern Corridor, which is China, Russia, Belarus, and then Belarus already borders Europe, was the preferred route over, and for both sides, for China and the West, because basically you went through one, one customs union across Russia and Belarus, and in one transportation system, and things seemed the least disruptible and the cheapest. But now everyone's looking for capacity on the Middle Corridor, and it's really something, a strategic development, something to watch. And yes, it benefits Iran. Actually, it benefits, China. It gives a new route to China. So again, we're solving one problem by sanctioning Russia and not transiting Russia. We're creating other problems by empowering China and Iran. Also, all the landlocked, most of the states above Iran's border, its northern border, are landlocked countries. Central Asia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and so as they look to use Russian transit less, or Russia doesn't allow them, they're looking for ways westward, but they're also looking southward across Iran. So this can benefit Iran. Actually, some of the countries like Azerbaijan closed its borders with Iran and Russia during COVID, and actually never reopened them, because they also had a war during the COVID period, and so they're not accepting sort of Russia goods trade with Russia to circumvent sanctions. But most of the other countries in the region that border Russia are in the end becoming sort of also a transit route for Russia, and that's also problematic. Also, Russia itself has been periodically blocking oil export from Kazakhstan, which goes through its territory into the Black Sea. So Russia, you know, so the way you jack up oil prices, if you're an oil producer and you want to jack up revenue, is you cut back production. But Russia found something better, is cutting back the production, or at least the export of its neighbor. So this way, prices go up, but Russia doesn't sell less volumes, you know, so it's a pretty good trick. So also Kazakhstan has been looking for more ways to get its oil out to market, you know, and some of that will be through Azerbaijan, you know, across the Caspian through Azerbaijan and joining the westward infrastructure. But some of that could end up under, you know, if there was a different sanctions regime going through Iran, potentially.
Yeah, that middle corridor that you know, China over to the Caspian, where you have Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan. That region, I think, is going to get a lot more attention as we go forward from this point in history. That might be a whole nother show.
I 100% agree with you, John, and you see it with. You know, Secretary Blinken receiving leaders from Central Asia. You saw this in the communique at the end of the recent G7 meeting, discussing about the importance of Central Asia. And I would say that there's something, I'm in the midst of writing about this right now, but I would say there's a rise of, I would call, like the Turkic corridor, which is Central Asia, Azerbaijan, and Turkey. You know, Turkey for years after the Soviet breakup was pretty standoffish about Central Asia. Also, it doesn't have a, you know, physical territorial connection. But, you know, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, with also the Armenia-Azerbaijan war in 2020, when Azerbaijan was able to, you know, reassert its territorial integrity and with somewhat with Turkish help, the states of Central Asia now are looking for you know, an outlet to the West, and they're also looking for, you know, strategic cooperation with a country other than Russia or China. And so, like, the first agreements ever signed by Central Asian states in the sphere of, in the strategic sphere, defense sphere, with any country except for Russia, were signed over the last year with Turkey. And it's something really worth watching. Like you said, both the trade level with the Middle Corridor, energy trade that's starting to go more from Central Asia into Turkey across the Caspian, but also a defense component.
And Iran is right astride that whole corridor. Dr. Schaefer, we have to take just a short break to recognize our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. We'll be right back.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back here at National Security This Week with our guest, Dr. Brenda Schaefer. Dr. Schaefer, I want to tap into your expertise some more on the security situation with regard to Iran. Maybe we can use what we've already learned from you about Iran's government structure and Iran's economy to help us consider Iran's overall security situation. Iran has a somewhat robust military. The traditional forces are referred to as the Artesh. But Iran also has that parallel organization that you mentioned earlier, a parallel organization to the traditional military, and that's the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Could you explain that construct to us, having these two kind of parallel defense organizations inside the Islamic Republic of Iran? How are they different?
Right. So, they're different in many ways. You know, the military is, would say, less political. It's made up, you know, they have a conscription and so not everyone who serves in the military necessarily identifies with the regime's goals or its policies. IRGC is a lot different, you know, so it's people that are, you know, volunteer to be part of the IRGC and are accepted to the IRGC. They have a lot bigger ideological and political, you know, commitment to the Islamic Republic. And as we discussed before, there's also this economic component where they basically own or run, you know, essential industries in Iran. So they have sort of their own economic base as well, and then economic interests of the various commanders. And IRGC has its officers and proxies all over the Middle East. I mean, basically the Middle East today without the IRGC's activities in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq would be a completely different Middle East, especially after the Abraham Accords, which basically opened up relations between Israel and most of the Arab states, that, you know, we probably could see a Middle East without Iranian intervention and terrorism, and we probably could see it in Middle East that was growing in prosperity and stability. Instead, you know, because of the Iranian activity, so many of the governments in the region have to spend resources and time just to try to keep their states stable because of Iranian destabilization activities.
And I do want to dive more deeply into Iran's foreign policy through the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in a few minutes. The Revolutionary Guard Corps, that's kind of a specialized organization. They have a couple of subordinate organizations. The Quds Force is one, which I want to dive into. But the economic side and sort of a regime stability side is also strongly supported by, I think it's called the Basij. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit more about the Basij?
Right. So I mean, Iran works, you know, while most militaries or paramilitary organizations work mostly on, you know, national threats from outside, Iran's works, you know, more on internal threats. And if you see the current demonstrations, you know, the regime throws the police first at people, then a little bit the military, but when they really want to finish people off, it's generally the Basij and the forces that are coming in, and, you know, very sort of specialized with the riot control and arrests. And, there's even some interesting elements where the IRGC has brought in foreign militias to put down some of the anti-regime activity. Like, for instance, there's about 5 million Arabs in Iran. They're ethnic Arabs, but they're you know, they live inside the territory of Iran, and the regime brought in militias from Lebanon and Iraq to suppress them twice already. So one, you know, so sort of the idea that if you bring in foreigners, it's sort of easier for them to kill these people, so there is this overlap between the external and internal missions because of these ethnic minorities, that the ethnic borders and the political borders in the region don't overlap.
And we should highlight for the audience, Basij is Basij. That's how it's spelled. But I'm a retired intelligence officer. I've seen lots of different estimates as to how many people are in the Basij. I think the kind of the going number is about 600,000. Is that sort of what you hear too in your circles?
Yeah, I don't know. I really can't comment.
Okay, and let's talk about the Quds Force. That's a very kind of unique part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. What is the Quds Force?
Right. So they also, you know, another militia that is that you have to get accepted to, you have to volunteer for, and gets, you know, also the Basij and the Quds Force get a lot of good resources, you know, from the government. So again, like their motivation to support the regime and to suppress the people is both, you know, some of it is ideological, they support the regime, but it's also, you know, it's quite beneficial to them economically. You know, they get special housing, you know, special prices, and, you know, they get a lot of economic benefits. An interesting thing that I was hearing from this last round of demonstrations, a difference between like Tehran and the provinces. So let's say that Basij forces and the Quds forces that live, you know, in Tehran, and they go out and they round up people, and they beat people. So like, well, they go back, and it's a big city. They, you know, they go back to their homes. People don't really know what they do and what they've done. But in small places, like, you know, like Abadan and Erdebil, you know, I've heard of where like actually activists have gone, you know, to the homes of some of these local Basij and local IRGC, and you know, threaten them. We know where your kids go to school, we know where your, you know, your wife works, and if you, you know, kill people, we understand you're not going to resign, but if you kill people, torture people, you know, you'll pay a price. And you've even seen some assassinations of IRGC police and besiege in their homes, during these different demonstrations, but it's only in the provinces because they're identifiable. Or you saw, like, for instance, in Zeidan's been having every Friday since late September, they've been having massive demonstrations there. There's been hundreds of people killed by the regime in Zeidan. It's in this Balochistan. And, you know, two of the guys that had really killed dozens of protesters one Friday, the next Friday they're sitting eating their breakfast, and they, you know, when their explosion goes off exactly where they're having their breakfast, and they're killed, right? So I think in the provinces, people are taking, you know, actually sort of personalized assassination against the local besiege and other IRGC police. So it's a very different. They're much more vulnerable than, let's say, in the big central cities of the country.
So I've noted that there are elements of the protest movement in Iran today, where initially it was sort of, hey, we want reforms, but now there is a I don't know if it's consensus, but there's certainly a group of the protesters who are basically saying an end to the Iranian regime as it exists today. I mean, complete reform, complete replacement of the government. That would be clearly anathema to what the Basij and the Quds Force and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps could possibly accept, let alone the political leadership of the country, kind of run by, you know, the Ayatollah Corps. Do you see the possibility of a counter revolution developing inside Iran? I mean, the whole structure is designed to keep control of the revolution, so to speak.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, yeah, John, I agree with you that this is a completely different moment. You know, the demonstrators are calling to bring down the regime, and they're not calling, you know, just to change an element of it or about a, you know, a contesting a certain election result or something. This is, I agree with you, it's fundamentally to bring down the regime. You know, how can it happen? You know, we actually had, I always look back to 1989. Maybe you were too young then. I don't know if you were a researcher yet, but I already was engaging in research. And 1989, you have basically when it's, I wouldn't say it was clear there was the fall of the Soviet Union, but it's clear that Moscow is losing control over the provinces, has very little deterrence against demonstrators. And at the same time, we have Tiananmen, meaning where you had like two what could have been existential threats to regimes, to powerful, you know, non-democratic regimes, and one regime that actually didn't use that much force, the Soviet Union, you know, collapses, and another regime that used a lot of force, you know, didn't collapse and easily suppressed the Tiananmen uprising. And you think, well, so there's like so a couple of, like, so the question is, you know, when does force help? When does force hurt, right? So like you think in the case of China, using overwhelming force, you know, killing probably thousands of demonstrators and within a day, you know, that worked. But also in cases when you do that, that could actually have the opposite results, and, you know, and really people have nothing to lose once they've lost, you know, family, their children, family members. And so I don't know, are we the Tiananmen movement or moment? Are we the Soviet moment? Are we, you know, it's, I think there's no theory. You know, I looked when I was starting to work on Iran, it's more than Persia. I was looking at all the theory on revolutions, and nothing really gives you a fundamental guide of what are the posts. I have a feeling that it, there's so little legitimacy of the institutions of the Islamic Republic, certainly in the provinces, but you know, also in the central cities, that I have a feeling it'll somewhat go the way of the USSR, which was sort of implosion. You know, that basically the people that were supposed to be there to keep it together will, you know, in some degree just kind of give up and try to find, you know, a safer place for themselves. But it's really hard, you know, to prove that outcome. But certainly I hope our analytical communities are, you know, looking at this carefully. It is kind of strange how we have this thing, like, you know, sort of also, you know, embedded in your question, like, can a regime, you know, just fall apart? I'm saying, like, well, I lived through, as a researcher, the USSR. Who among us thought that the USSR would break up, the Soviet Union would, you know, would just go away and, you know, into the trash bin of history, and it did, right? So I think you know, of course, these regimes at some point will fall apart. You know, they don't deliver the goods economically. They don't deliver security to people. You know, I don't think every non-democratic regime is going to necessarily change, but I think certainly ones like Iran that don't deliver any of the goods to their public, you know, they can't sustain indefinitely.
So not, in addition to the international community pressures on Iran impacting the economy because of Iranian actions in the region and around the world, and the fact that the construct of the government and, to a certain extent, the security force is designed to maintain control in a very authoritarian, very authoritarian way, you also have layered over that a population explosion in Iran that has happened over the course of, you know, since 1979, since the revolution. A huge percentage of the population is under the age of 40. And these are people who are connected to the world. They know what the world is like. Is that friction going to be maybe the change that, I mean, what's your prediction on how this is going to play out?
Definitely that's part of it. You know, like all the, anything that we knew in the past, we know this, but in our country as well, you know, of course, social media, the internet changes attitudes, behavior, so much. I think part of this recent round, if you look at the social media of many of these young women who were killed, you know, they were following Western singers. I looked at the social media of a lot of these women that were killed, especially at the beginning, were from the minority. So whether it was the first woman who was killed, Gina, was a Kurdish, and the next sort of handful of women that were killed were Azerbaijani Turks. And I looked at the Turkish social media of these girls. They were following, you know, singers in Turkey and movie stars in Turkey, and the pictures of themselves were, you know, in Western clothes, and you know, it's clear that they had a, you know, a different, you know, different, didn't identify with the regime, and many of them, you know, they were using their primary language in social media, which social media is already, I think it's had a huge impact on the minorities as well, because suddenly instead of just like, well, they just get Persian and, you know, Persian television, Persian media, they now can have Kurdish, you know, watch TV in Kurdish, like all the ethnic minorities watch foreign television in their own languages. So whether it's Azerbaijanis watching television from Azerbaijan and Turkey, whether it's Arabs watching TV shows from the Gulf, Kurds watching Kurdish TV from Iraqi Kurdistan and from Europe. So the internet and satellite TV and social media has really had a huge impact on everyone, but also specifically on the ethnic minorities. I think something also to watch, maybe even as Americans, we need to watch this, is the very low birth rates in Iran. They don't have a replacement birth rate. I think that tells you a lot about a people not being optimistic about its future. You know, and people are sort of happy, feel prosperous. They tend to have children. You know, we've also had a huge reduction in the birth rate in the United States is also something to think about. But I look at that a lot. I think it tells those kind of trends when there is access to birth control and sort of, you know, the number of children is a choice and it does represent, you know, something. And so when you have below replacement level, I think that is a sign of a lack of optimism about the future in Iran. There's also even very, you know, low marriage rates as well. I've heard of many families where, you know, the women don't want to get married because they don't want to have to go under the rule of a husband. But it also tells you that they're, you know, the people are not living sort of normal, you know, normal lives. So. Yeah.
For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Brenda Schaefer from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and we're discussing the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. Dr. Schaefer, so far we've covered many of the things about Iran that are sort of concerning. We've covered oil and gas sector, how it feeds revenue to the government, certainly to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. We've covered broader economic challenges and why the Iranian people sort of suffer under these sanctions due to the Iranian government's actions. We looked at some of those actions concerning the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps activities in the region. Talked a little bit about Quds Force and the fact that they do have agents operating around the region. supporting Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, probably Hamas in Gaza and elsewhere. We would be remiss if we did not cover in some detail the really concerning issue connected to Iran, and that's the pursuit of their nuclear program. And nuclear power is one thing, and I think most nations would support Iran investing in a nuclear power program that used reactor technologies and uranium refinement that were not also capable of building nuclear weapons. But that's not the case with the Iranian program. Iran is definitely on a path that will give them the capability to build nuclear weapons. And they have been also purchasing more advanced combat aircraft, building a better navy. They've spent a good bit of time developing ballistic missile and drone technologies. If we were to look at this issue using sort of clear, logical assessments based on what we know to be true about Iran's government, their military, Iran's position in the Middle East, the tenets of Persian culture and Shiite Islam, how should we assess Iran's nuclear program?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so first again, your first point about, well, everyone would support them having, you know, nuclear energy, but not nuclear weapons. I think, you know, it's kind of, Iran has the second largest volumes of natural gas in the world. And actually, it has a very interesting domestic use of energy. About 70% of its fuel mix is natural gas. So they, you know, they overwhelmingly use it for its power production. They use it in industry and petrochemicals. I mean, so they have almost, you know, if they had a normal economy and normal investments, they have almost unlimited natural gas. And natural gas, you know, producing electricity from natural gas is a lot cheaper than from nuclear. So actually, it wouldn't make any sense for a natural gas superpower to actually have a nuclear, you know, nuclear energy. And the only reason they would do it would be, and or why they're doing it would be either to have a sort of a framework for nuclear weapons activity. And also something that's kind of strange in the Middle East is that nuclear energy is still like a prestige project. It's kind of funny because it's a over 70-year-old technology. I think you should move on to some other type of prestige. But also there is this, you know, in terms of the strategic cooperation, competition with its neighbors, you know, it's kind of whoever has nuclear energy, it's sort of like they're a step closer also to nuclear weapons, and that this is some kind of, you know, it's seen as a symbol of power in the region. But yeah, we've seen Iran is getting closer and closer to essentially to a virtual nuclear weapon, which means, you know, that they have all the different components, and they basically just have to decide to, you know, to test and deploy. You know, so they're pretty close to that threshold. You know, and it's really you know, a question if how the Biden administration is going to approach it. It seems that it prefers to try through some sort of you know, renewed JCPOA. And in fact, you know, under this situation, we're seeing that, you know, despite these massive anti-regime demonstrations, the U.S. is pretty ambivalent, because at the same time it wants, you know, in Europe as well, because the U.S. wants to get, you know, to negotiate. So they're not really pointing out, you know, a lot of these violations. It was interesting, about 2 weeks ago, the regime executed a Swedish citizen. He was of Iranian Arab origin. They lured him to Istanbul. They kidnapped him in Istanbul, drugged him, and drove him across Turkey. They've kept him in Iran now for close to 3 years, and they just executed him 2 weeks ago. And you think, like, this is a Swedish citizen. That's a Swedish passport. And basically nothing from the EU, from Sweden, only some sort of tepid response that we're against, you know, capital punishment. You know, so basically they, you know, Iran can strike and hurt activists, anti-regime activists, you know, in Europe and even in the United States. And basically the Western governments do very little or nothing, because they still want to somehow get to a negotiated settlement with Iran.
So unfortunately, we're starting to close in on the end of our hour today. But let me ask you this. If Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon, would Saudi Arabia counter the challenge from Iran with a nuclear program of their own? Would Israel be compelled to strike Iran's nuclear facilities? We've heard some of that threat from the Israeli government. Would that mean a general theater war? And let me ask you this. Is Iran's program today a third or fourth order, maybe we call it a negative consequence of the AQ Khan network that began many years ago out of Pakistan. Are we seeing the end results now of that proliferation effort from within Pakistan, supported by the People's Republic of China, actually? I know that's a great deal to unpack, and we don't have a ton of time, but maybe you could take a swing at any of those topics in whatever order you wish.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, definitely there already is, in a sense, a regional arms race, you know, everyone looking if the big danger of Iran getting nuclear weapons is not just the fact that it could use those nuclear weapons, even though, you know, in most cases it probably wouldn't use them. But then all this regional meddling it's doing, you know, in Iraq, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Azerbaijan, Turkey, where it's, you know, it's trying to destabilize these countries, where it's supporting anti-regime acting militias. You know, it would be very hard to push back against this activity when Iran has nuclear weapons. It's like, you know, they're in a different category. You know, you can't really take that risk. So I think many are more concerned about many countries, what kind of regional role this would have. You know, will Israel strike at the nuclear program? I it seems that Israel's strategy has been more, instead of waiting till Iran has nuclear weapons, doing everything to dismantle the program as it's being built, you know, wherever it can. And, you know, that seems to be any opportunity it has to, you know, take apart a part of it. And it seems like U.S. government is fine with that. Doesn't, you know, on one hand, it's negotiating with Iran, but doesn't really mind that Israel, when it can, that it dismantles parts of it. Dismantle, I guess, is kind of a nice word, but dismantles parts of the program, which, of course, even makes it easier for the U.S. to get to a deal with Iran, because if there's less for Iran to, if Iran doesn't have that much more, you know, to something viable to shut down, you know, it's easier for Iran to give in. But of course, Iran keeps pursuing and building, and, you know, and these things are very, you know, very difficult to completely dismantle.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're down to just 4 minutes left in the show today. We've covered a lot of ground today, a whole bunch of other questions that I would have loved to ask you. But unfortunately, you know, like I said, the time flies on this show. I always try to give my guests sort of the final word here. What final thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners on the topic of Iran or broader national security challenges and issues in the Middle East? The floor is yours.
Oh, my God. That's a hard one. Yeah, I would say that, you know, just like the demise of the Soviet Union, you know, we can learn a lot of lessons from that. We didn't think the demise was possible, and look at it, it happened. People were following the ethnic groups, but I don't think, you know, I remember people at the time, experts on the USSR, U.S. national security experts, saying, you really think that Kyrgyzstan is going to be a country? You know, I think we really couldn't imagine these kind of developments, you know, and who could have imagined, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall. I mean, I got into this whole topic of Iran. You started with your first question when, as a Soviet analyst, that everyone was looking at the fall of the Berlin Wall and what's happening, you know, with Eastern and Western Europe uniting, what's going to happen. And I said, hey, what happens when the wall falls between the Soviet Union and the Middle East? That's what I want to look at. And that's how I got into this whole topic of Iran, especially the ethnic minorities, because it was clear to me that, well, there's these new countries, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and, like, let's say Republic of Azerbaijan at the time of independence had 9 million people. I looked across the border, wow, 30 million Azerbaijanis in Iran. And, you know, Turkmenistan had at the time of independence about 4 million people, you know, across the border, similar amount, you know, in Iran. I said, wow, it has to be that these ethnic minorities are going to be affected by sort of their co-ethnics having national states on their borders. Let's take a look at it. So I've spent about 30 years, time goes by, you know, looking at that. I think we have to learn, like, learn some lessons from the USSR, from what we didn't know, from what we made mistakes, and maybe not, and make sure we don't make those same mistakes about Iran. So I think things are much more dynamic there than maybe many of us appraise.
Yeah, and on that point about kind of, you know, ethnic groups and where they reside in the region, I think some of our listeners might recall after the U.S. Invaded Iraq in 2003, there was some discussion about, okay, what do you do with Iraq? We've been redrawing the map all over the world after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Should the Kurds have a homeland in the north? And that was, that idea was rejected soundly by our NATO ally, Turkey. But there's also an impact there because Syria has a significant Kurdish population. Northern Iran has a significant Kurdish population. These are all these aspirations that you were just talking about with regards to the ethnic groups in the region. It's a very complex place in the world, no question about it. We're going to have to bring this show sort of to a close here. Professor Brenda Schaefer, currently with the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and a couple of think tanks in Washington, D.C. as well. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and insights with us this morning. Are there any resources you might highlight for our listeners so they can learn a little bit more about Iran or related topics? Your website as well, if you'd be willing to share that.
Right. So Iran is More Than Persia, Ethnic Politics in Iran. It's my most recent book. It's available on Amazon and all the major booksellers are directly from the press, De Gruyter Press. And it's also available in ebook, almost all academic libraries in the United States to carry it. So if you don't want to buy the book, you can actually read it through your local university library, and that's fine. Of course, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, one of the think tanks I'm affiliated with, conducts very serious research on Iran. A lot to follow there.
And your website? You have your own website?
Yeah, but my website is not so active itself, but through Twitter, Prof. B. Schaefer. I post most of my publications there and thoughts about the developments in Iran, developments in the Caspian region, and also the international energy market.
So Professor Brenda Schaefer, author of the book Iran is More Than Persia, Ethnic Politics in Iran, which launched in December of last year, 2022. Thank you for joining us here on National Security This Week. You also have a new book, Operational Energy. When is that one coming out?
By the end of the year, it should be out. It's a textbook, though. It's for you kind of a Navy guys.
Perfect, perfect.
Across the U.S. military.
Yeah, in the Navy, we think all the time about fuel state on board our ships out at sea, so that's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
That closes this edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today here on KYMN Radio. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.